All of us have certain people in our lives who seem to keep popping up over and over again, no matter where you go, who you're with, or what you're doing. George Glasgow Jr. is one of those people for me. He's the proprietor of London's GJ Cleverly, which is arguably the finest maker of bespoke shoes in the world. I mean, name me a famous or important person from the last 75 years or so, and I can almost guarantee you that they had a pair or two of Cleverlys in their closet. George and I first met close to a decade ago when I was writing about classic menswear, and through a mix of mutual friends, overlapping businesses, and of course, a shared love of watches, we stayed in touch basically the whole time. In fact, one of the earliest Hodinkee product collaborations was a limited edition set of watch straps made by Cleverly out of this insanely rare Russian reindeer leather from the 18th century, but that's a story for another time. Right now, George is on one of his biannual tours of the United States to fit customers for shoes, and during a free afternoon in New York, I was able to get him into the studio, along with our own Cara Barrett, to talk about why he has a deep affection for Patek Philippe, the craziest shoe request he's ever gotten, and that one time that Daniel Day-Lewis asked his dad to be in a movie over lunch. Yeah, this is kind of a wild one. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Good to have you here, George. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got Cara Barrett here, too.
Hi, guys.
So you're in town, George, for the beginning of a pretty breakneck month-long tour of the U.S., right?
Yeah, so I do these trips twice a year to the U.S. We start in New York. We do about a week here. And then we head over to San Francisco for 3 days, then on to L.A. for a week. And then it goes really throughout the rest of the U.S. So that hits up Austin, Dallas, Houston, Washington, Chicago, Atlanta, Boston, and then Toronto. So it's pretty lengthy.
Yeah, that's no joke.
I was gonna say it's a bit like the Rolling Stones tour. I just don't get paid like them.
Do you take a bus or do you fly?
Do you know what? It's actually funny you say that. So we used to fly everywhere, and now when we get to Texas, we actually, you're gonna laugh at this, we Uber.
Oh my gosh, between
you
cities?
Uber from Houston to Austin to Dallas?
So we Uber and we get, so the first time we ever did it, so here's, because there's a few of us traveling and we have quite a bit of luggage. So I said, look, you know, going to the airport, the time it's an hour into there, then you got the flight, then you got checking in, and then on the other side, why don't we just Uber? It'll be 3 hours, 4 hours max. So, you know, and obviously you book it on the app and you see it there and you put in where you're going. The lady turned up and she said, oh, where are you guys off to? This was in Houston. And I said, oh, we're going to Dallas. And she said, oh, so we're dropping you at the airport. I said, no, we're going to Dallas. So she started laughing, and she thought I was, like, joking. And she goes, oh, we're putting the luggage in. I said, no, really, is that okay with you? She said, not Dallas Street. I said, no, Dallas. And then so she goes to the front of her car, swipes, because they don't know until they start the app, swipes it, and she's like, oh, my God, you're going to Dallas. I went, yeah, that's what I've been trying to tell you. So we're in the car. After, like, 20 minutes, phone rings. She goes, oh, do you mind if I take a few calls? Because it's a long trip. I said, go for it. So it was her son. The son comes on the thing and says, hey, Mum, what time are you going to be home for dinner? She goes, well, I'm on my way to Dallas. And Dallas? Is that the same thing as before? He's like, what are you doing there? And apparently it was the longest fare she'd ever had. So we do this, and we've had some really interesting situations where Uber drivers have other jobs, and they're like, well, I need to be back. I can't be gone. This is going to take me 8 hours round trip. So then you'll get some that cancel it and whatever. But yeah, we Uber through.
That is wild.
That's pretty amazing. Crazy.
Texas is huge.
Yeah, Texas is gigantic.
It's not like, that's amazing.
It's honestly, it's really, and I don't, you know, it sounds weird when you tell people the story, like, really, did you do that? But it's actually the same amount of time as if we'd fly. But you're in the back of the car.
Right. Yeah.
You can do your emails. You can write up your order. Do anything you want to do. Have a nap.
See the sights.
See the sun. Here, exactly.
Yeah.
I was going to say all the cows in the interstate. You know, stop at the Chuck E. Cheese or whatever it is on the way. So it's so we do that, but everywhere else we fly.
That's there you go. I wasn't expecting that answer.
Yeah,
and
me neither.
I'm really glad that I got it.
That's incredible.
I was about to say, I should be one of Uber's best customers.
Yeah, seriously.
For real. Comes again.
You've got
really
the like
high.
Double diamond, like super secret status that we all want.
The number one Texan Uber user.
Wow.
Like, we have this random guy from England, Ubers across the state
You're
of Texas
legend.
Twice a year.
Could you imagine what would happen if the Uber drivers also knew what was in your luggage? That you just had piles of bespoke shoe samples?
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's hilarious because sometimes I've gone through airports. And as I say, it's always interesting because we have quite a few trunks. So we ship a lot. And you'll get a customs officer occasionally will open it and he'll see who it's for, like the name or something. And it totally then diverts his attention. He's like, oh my God, that's so cool. That you're making a shoe for that guy? You know, it's like, it's really then quite a different experience. And you're like, oh, that's pretty good. He's like, yeah, have a great stay, buddy. And then you're through. And
I also feel like in Texas, that's the one place where you can carry shoe leathers because they all get their custom-made cowboy boots
down
there. Oh,
that's true, yeah.
So,
yeah,
like, if you're going to carry around a bunch of leathers, including alligator skin, I imagine that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's definitely the state to do it in.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like everyone I meet there wears either cowboy boots or have had cowboy boots made.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the actual whole idea or concept of bespoke is pretty well received, and particularly amongst younger guys.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which, you know, we're seeing a big change in now.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So have you done these tours for a long time? I mean, I know you visited New York and LA for a while, but is that many markets being interested? Is that something new?
No. I mean, we've been doing the trunk show tours for about 40 years.
Okay.
So my dad has been doing it over 40 years. I started doing it about sort of 12 years ago. But I was doing it probably 10 years before that. You know, meeting my dad in New York and LA and places before I moved there for a while. And and sort of just organically sort of got introduced to it, I guess you could say. But it's been going for, you know, particularly the cities like New York, San Francisco, LA, Philadelphia, and a few of those have been going, I'd say, 40 years. We've added cities like Atlanta. But I mean, you know, when I say add, I mean, still for at least 10 years. You know, so it's quite a long time. And there's a lot of demand in these cities. And I think it's back to whole, you know, because Instagram and, you know, all these websites and the access to information now, probably almost how, like, you and I first met when we started that Watch Strap collaboration.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That was, what, 10, 11 years ago?
Yeah, I guess it was
literally when you...
It was 9 years ago.
7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. So it's quite... So, you know, people are finding information out there on all these products a lot earlier than they would have done sort of before the internet.
Yeah.
So people are, you know, seeing bespoke, seeing shoes, and then they're actually accessing their website and saying, oh, look, they go to this city. Oh, wow, they come to Atlanta. Or they come to, you know, certain cities like Austin, and they, you know, which 10 years ago we didn't do. Now we're doing all these cities, and they're actually as busy, if not busier, than some of the cities like New York. You know, New York's always going to be, you know, great, you know, because there's a lot of people here that, you know, and plus we've built up a clientele over 40 years. So you're always going to have a good business here. But people that are in these other states didn't have access maybe to bespoke clothing and especially bespoke shoes from England.
Yeah.
And now like, wow, these guys come twice a year to my own state. And I can come in and I can order as if I lived in London.
Yeah.
So, which is quite nice.
Yeah. That's amazing.
That's great.
Can you maybe walk people through what you do at Cleverly for some people who might not know? I realize we're kind of talking about it as if we all know what's going on, but like bespoke shoes is a kind of esoteric thing, I think, for some people.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure what I do either, actually. No, I'm just, you know, because...
Like, I just show up.
Yeah, I just show up. You know. No, but on a serious note, I mean, that's what I think is quite unique about our company is no one really has specific roles in the sense that, you know, some days we can be meeting with clients. You know, some days we could be doing trunk shows, some days we'd be in the workshop, some days we could be out buying leathers. You know, it's really quite an amazing business from that standpoint because every day I wake up and I've got something completely different. And I could be in a different city, I could be doing... And I'm sort of, I don't want to say not a control freak, but I kind of like to know all aspects of the business. Mm. So if I go downstairs into the basement where all our packing department is and I see a pair of shoes for a customer, I'll pack them. You know, I'll see. I remember that guy, and I'll just jot a little note inside it for him and pop it in the box. You know, if I'm out at the factory, I'll be buying leathers. You know, I love developing colors, patinas. I like bringing something unique to my clients, and the only way to do that really is to do it yourself. Because then you know, you meet your customer, you know what he's looking for. You go to the tannery, you know what to develop, because the people that are sort of making all these unique skins, they not necessarily know what your customer's looking for, whereas on, and there's no shortcut. So every day is very different at Cleverly's for me. And it's the same with my dad. You know, he'll be doing one thing one moment, and the same with our shoemakers. You know, you got Adam, who is our workshop director. One minute he might be in there cutting a pair of shoes. The next minute he's on a plane traveling to do a trunk show. Or we could be seeing a customer in the shop, or we could be doing an event with a gallery. Or so. I mean, it really is, there's no 2 days the same, which I think is what really makes it so interesting for me, because I don't feel like I actually work, if that makes sense. Because when you wake up, you know, and I know we've spoken about this before, but when you wake up and you enjoy what you do, mm-hmm. you don't then have that Sunday blues or you know,
yeah.
you know that
thought
on a Sunday. Yeah. And we've all been there, you know, on the yeah. Sunday, like, oh God, I've got to go this on Monday. And see, I actually generally look forward to it. And most people that are coming in buying bespoke shoes or ready-made shoes, or I've met them, I've come in and said, hey, I've got a pair of your shoes at Mr. Porter. I'd love to get a pair of bespoke ones, or I'd like to do this. You know, it's generally people that are quite enthusiastic and they're there. You're not really selling. They're there because they want to buy something.
Yeah.
And they want to order something.
Right.
So it's not, you're not sort of pitching because they make appointments. It's a totally different personal relationship than from just standing in a shop.
Yeah. You don't have to convince them. They seek you out for your product because they're interested
in
buying it.
Yeah, I mean, they seek you out. They know that you're, you know, I don't want to say, but the best at what you do, or, you know, and they come to you and they find the whole, you know, the whole experience from start to finish really enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Because almost to what you guys do, anyone that sort of goes onto your website or your blog or listens to your podcast, it feels like they do feel like they're part of something. Yeah. And it's the same with George Cleverly. Unlike any of our competitors, and it's not me sitting there saying, oh, we're the best, but, you know, it feels like a club. And that's yeah. the atmosphere that we try yeah. and create, that you're not just another customer. You're not just someone coming in ordering a pair of shoes. You know, you're going to come in, you're going to meet the shoemakers, you're going to meet me, you're going to meet my dad, you're going to meet all the product, you're going to see all the product. You're going to see us on a regular basis, whether it be in this city or another city. And I think that makes the experience really, back to the word bespoke, because mm-hmm. that's really how it should be. So, yeah, that's sort of a...
That sounds lovely. Maybe I should get a pair of shoes. Having,
not to low-key humble brag, but having had a pair of shoes made, it's a totally unreal experience. And I mean, it's something that's substantively different, I think, than getting a suit made, for instance. And I think, you know, we've seen a kind of explosion in the number of, you know, maybe more entry-priced options for made-to-measure or bespoke suit options. So I think a lot more young men specifically have experienced having a custom suit or a custom jacket or a pair of trousers made. But bespoke shoes are still something super rare and super elevated. I mean, even a lot of guys who have been having suits made for 20, 30 years at the best tailors have never bought a pair of bespoke shoes.
Yeah. Well, and also, here's the thing. You know, for bespoke shoes, and people say, how many competitors do you have? And stuff, we really don't have many competitors, because actually to make a fully bespoke shoe is so difficult. And there are hardly any craftsmen in the business, really. So I know most of them. And it's not like, you know, like you said about the tailoring and the made to measure. There's so many different variations out there of suit options that you could say, oh, I live in, you know, Texas. I live in, you know, Hawaii or Florida. And everyone has a local tailor, you know, or a local shirt maker. You're like, oh, I've got this guy that does this. But if you talk about genuine, fully bespoke, handmade shoes, and I mean, not just from England, I mean, anywhere, there isn't that many. And there's only a few in each, I mean, really generally making a fully bespoke shoe where the start to finish is all done by hand. That is, you know, a rarity. And therefore, and it's very specialized. So the people that get into it, and it's quite iconic because, you know, shoes are sold in pairs. But in all the years we've ever been measuring customers, we've never seen a pair of feet. And a lot of people don't actually think about that. Yeah. And you like see the measurements, you're like, you're actually half a size. It's actually common to be half a size difference.
Mm.
But yet, but everyone buys shoes in pairs. You're a 7 or an 8 or an 8.5, whatever it is. So that's why you've always got a shoe that's either a bit tight or a bit big or what have you. But, you know, it is a rarity.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, how have you seen the business change maybe over the last like 10 or 15 years? As, you know, you already mentioned Instagram, and as kind of the like hashtag menswear world has exploded. Have you seen kind of like the demands your customers are putting on you or the sorts of questions they're asking? Have you seen that change, or even maybe the types of shoes they're ordering change?
Yeah, well, there's been a bunch of changes. I mean, I'd say the first change is the age group. When I first got into this business, it was definitely an older customer. And when I say older, I'm probably, you know, around the 60s. That was two reasons. One is because of the price point. It's expensive. So it took a while for, you know, for people to get into the position to be able to, you know, buy a pair of handmade shoes or fully bespoke shoes. And the second was the access to the information to even know that it existed. Because I've got clients of mine, you know, I remember, you know, a few years back, I was coming down to the West Village to measure A-Rod for a pair of shoes. And, you know, he found the whole process, you know, mind-blowing, really. He was like, this is amazing. And the amount of people, and he was like, I didn't even know that this sort of thing existed. Mm-hmm. And he showed me a handmade shoe. And I was like, that's not a handmade shoe. It says it's handmade shoe, but it's not a handmade shoe. It's not completely hand-stitched. That's a machine-stitched sole. But that's where the term gets thrown around a lot, handmade. Mm. And then you see it. And then he was like, wow, I didn't even know this whole thing existed. And that's what I see the big change is. people are coming in, and when they're seeing the whole process and they see the workshop above our store in London, or they come into a trunk show and they see all these fittings with shoes with no soles on, I think it's like a new world that they've sort of explored. And as I say, the age now has drastically dropped. I mean, I would say the average age of guys coming in to see us is in their 40s. That is a big drop from, you know, 60s within 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's a combination of reasons. Again, access to the information. So they're like, you know what? I want to treat myself to a really nice pair of shoes, you know, even if it's one pair. So you might have, you know, a guy coming in as CEO of a major bank or a corporation, followed by, you know, a school teacher that wants a nice pair of shoes that saved up and said, you know what, I want to buy one pair a year or one pair every few years, and these are going to last me 30, 40 years, which they do. So that's a difference in the customer. And then in terms of, you know, what they're looking for, I guess they're looking for things that are more unique. You know, the day of selling just a black Oxford, which is traditionally what English shoes are sort of built after. Oxford's not brogues like Kingsman, right? You know, it's that day is not sale. People will still buy Oxfords and Derbys and things like that, but they want something a bit more unique. They want something with a unique material or a unique pattern on it. They want something that's a bit more individual to them as a person, and not something that's run-of-the-mill where you'd walk in, you'd be like, oh yeah, I could get that shoe anywhere. They want something where someone says, oh, where'd you get that? I've never seen that from. Yeah. So that's probably how it's changed the most.
You know, you're in kind of a unique position too, because you didn't just enter the business already as a professional. You kind of grew up in the business, right?
Yeah, well, this is the ironic thing. So I grew up in the business, you know, Saturday jobs, you know, summer intern, all that type of stuff. And I had all the grunt work, George, go pack this, go make the tea, all that type of good stuff. And then sort of, you know, I went to school for economics. I went to University of London for economics and politics, which not many people know. And I went into the whole banking thing for a short while. And it was around the same time Ben actually was in it. And I sort of just, you know, it all sounded quite glamorous. You know, everyone got paid well. They all looked really good, all in suits. Everyone's out hustling. And I thought, it's amazing. And I ended up getting a job at a company in New York. But I ultimately wanted to be in LA. Mm. That was the sort of place I wanted to be because it was so different from London. So I managed to get a transfer very quick from New York out to LA. And then it was for a short while, it was really, you know, super fun. I sort of was out in Vegas, you know, doing construction deals with the team. And it was really quite interesting. And then after about, I guess, 2 years, 2.5 years, you know, you had that Sunday blues where you're like, you know, getting ready in the morning. You're, oh, God, I've got the whole week of this. And I knew at that time it wasn't where my heart lied. And then, you know, everything else aside, it wasn't something I generally enjoyed. Whereas I would use my vacation at the bank to go and do trunk shows. And that was when I was like, I'm doing something wrong here. Yeah, I'm like, in Texas. And I'm like, I'm going to Dallas. You know, it's a new market. And I was like, this is crazy. You know, I'm using my 10 days or 2 weeks. You get a lot less in America.
Yeah, yeah. It's about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's
about 2 weeks.
That's generous.
Well, and you tell them, you're like, by the way, I'm going away for 2.5 weeks. Like, 2.5 weeks?
You're taking time? I'm sorry,
and
what?
And you're like, oh, sorry. I'm
how
going on
dare
a holiday.
You're
yeah.
using
how
your
dare
vacation
you?
Days?
Yeah, they're like, don't you want to be paid out for it? I'm like, no, I want to go on vacation. You know, but I would take it to go do trunk shows. And, you know, and then, you know, sort of as you get into it more, just the people you would meet were incredible. You know, and the places you'd end up. I mean, and I have so many stories in nearly every city that is just surreal. You know, it really is quite, you wouldn't believe that you're in those positions. Mm. And you're like, this is amazing. And you'd have so much fun. And then towards like the end of it, you'd be like, oh, I'm going back to work now. To the other work. And you're like, this is not good.
No.
And
that's how you know you need a change.
Yeah. And then and then it was back to the whole thing. Can you do bespoke shoes in Los Angeles? Which is where I spent a big bunch of my time. And if you know a lot about sort of, you know, bespoke clothing in London, the hub of it is New York in terms of clientele. Everyone yeah. would go, let's go to New York. You know, a lot of, you know, sort of shirt makers and shoemakers would all set up in New York. That was the first place that everyone always came. And it always used to blow my mind because I said, you know, LA is full of people that are stylish. LA is full of people that like nice, you know, quality luxury goods. Why does no one go out to Los Angeles? Maybe it's a suit thing because of the climate, but I was like, it's got nothing to do with the shoes. You know, you can wear chukka boots, you can wear loafers, all that type of great stuff. So we set up an office out there and sort of continued. And it really just was amazing what we were able to achieve in a market where sort of, I don't want to say everyone left, but no one like, none of our competitors had stores there.
Yeah.
And if they did, it was a small one out in South Coast Plaza. No one was in Beverly Hills. And I thought, this is amazing because, you know, all the other brands are here. All the other sort of major luxury jewelry brands, watch brands, you know, everyone's there. But there's no real high-end luxury shoemaker. So we sort of went in there and then we have a close relationship with Hollywood. as you know, both on the customer side and the film side. And it sort of just organically grew from there. And being based there made it so much more obviously accessible. So, you know, the requests you would get were crazy. You know, you'd just suddenly be called by someone, oh, can you come over to my house? And you're like, you know, and you'd be sitting in their living room, you're like, this is crazy. Yeah. And yeah, and then they would introduce you because it's a very word of mouth business. And then, you know, the business sort of organically grew from there. So I stayed in Los Angeles and I stayed there for, well, I was there totally 11 years.
Wow.
And that, yeah, and then I decided to move back to London about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, because I got married. And yeah, and sort of the rest is sort of history. But we still go out there, you know, all the time. But it's funny how life, you know, you end up in certain places and you meet people and, you know, I have to say, you know, LA was an amazing time.
Yeah.
And it was it's an amazing city as well for clientele and people that generally appreciate handmade bespoke. Same with the watches. You know, you'd spend time there and you'd meet these amazing collectors. And does anyone know about this? You know, the West Coast is something, I don't know why, but it's like, oh, they're out on the West Coast. I'm like, yeah, but it's amazing, you know, and the weather's awesome.
It's pretty good out there.
I love LA.
We haven't talked about this in, what, like 2 or 3 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, LA is the same, in my mind, it's the same distance from New York to LA that it is from New York to London. It's just roughly the same flight. I mean, LA flight's like four and a half hours, and on a good day to London, it's like 5.5 hours.
Yeah, that's correct.
So it is foreign. It is really far. So it is a place that you kind of forget about. And then you go out there and you're like, this is a wonderful place. And everyone's nice.
Car has a giant smile on her face right now.
And everyone's happy, sort of, except for the traffic. But it's just...
I could see a Houdinki office opening soon.
Same.
Guess
who would run
Interesting.
It.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's approved immediately.
Yeah, that's good. It's good. It's fine. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned watches and, you know, I know you are a watch guy.
Yeah.
How did you get into watches?
Do you know what? It's funny because, you know, people always say about being a watch collector and what have you. And up until, you know, maybe even a year or so ago, I didn't even really associate myself as a collector. And the reason being is because, you know, you think of a watch collector and you think of, you know, you see these videos and stories that guys have got 100 watches. And I'd always think, well, that's definitely not me because I don't have 100 watches. But... or a big collection of one particular brand. And the more people I started to meet when I got more involved in this was interesting because you get guys that might have a small collection of Amigas, but he was a collector. And each one was a collection, not because of just purely because of the value, because there was a story behind each one. And that's always how I've been. I've never, you know, when I've looked at a watch, I've never purchased a watch based on its value or how much I'm going to make for it because I've never sold a watch. And I find that interesting because, you know, a lot of people get watches and they put them in safes and they store them and they're, you know, you see them advertised as box fresh. I wear my watches all the time and I wear them everywhere, you know, and even, you know, my wife will be like, she'll be like, oh, take a few links out of this, let me wear this or something. I'm like, no, you can wear these. Because I know once the links come out, they'll never get put back in.
That's
the biggest battle I have. Yeah, so I always have to, you know, have that issue with it. But, you know, that's how I got, you know, watch I've got, and I haven't got loads, but I've got some decent watches. For me, each has a bit of a story behind it, and each one means a lot to me to the point where I wouldn't part with it. Unless my circumstances change or something happened, I had to sell something,
right. But
I wouldn't sell it. And that's why people say, you know, I've been quite fortunate that I've got some watches that have gone up in value. And, you know, I always say, you know, it's like a house. It doesn't matter how much they're worth. If you're not selling it, what does it matter really? Right. It's nice to know. It's a good comfort level.
Yeah.
But I've never been a collector that's bought something based on how much
that
I could sell it for down the road. And, you know, I had a bit of a bad experience because the first couple of watches that I got a tag and that got stolen. And it was a bit brutal because it was one of those, you know, when you have a house party, back in the day, it was my fault to an extent. I shouldn't have left it on the side in the bedroom. Someone obviously went. Anyway, long story short, the watch disappeared. And I was sort of a bit heartbroken by that. And I was like, I can't believe someone took the watch. I was like, it was really frustrating. And then for a while, I didn't get a new watch. Because I was so distraught.
Yeah, you couldn't bring yourself to replace it.
Yeah, and I think that's it as well. Because you feel like you've lost an old friend.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so... it was so sort of, and it wasn't at the time, you know, insurance, I didn't insure it, it was all these little things. And it was a big, you know, for me at the time, it was a big pill to swallow. And I thought, God, you know, I'm not going to buy another watch for a while until I find something that, you know, I really, really want. And then I went through a bit of a dodgy phase, I would call it, where I wanted...
What? Explain.
So I was into this whole... Do you remember when... what was the watch brand that had all the diamonds on it that you don't see much anymore? It was...
Frank Mueller?
No. It was Marc Jacobs. No, not Marc Jacobs. What's it? Jacobs & Co.
Still around.
No, still around. Yeah. But do you remember there was that era where everyone... I didn't get that watch. But do you remember there was that era of everyone getting diamonds and things like that?
Tell me more.
Yeah, no, so I didn't get that watch. I wasn't that guy. I couldn't afford that watch.
I would love that. That would be a great twist to this story.
Yeah, imagine that was me in the nightclub with the diamonds. Yeah.
Okay. You're like, and then I replaced my tag with a Jacob & Co. diamond.
Yeah, I was like, and things changed.
I was heartbroken.
Yeah. And I had to have something that spoke to me. No. And I was around the corner from us is in Bond Street is Bulgari.
Yeah.
And Nicola Bulgari is a good client of ours. And he's a lovely guy. And I sort of told him the story of you know, the tag and what have you. He said, oh, you should come in, see some of our watches. And so time went by and it was close to Christmas. So I ended up going in there and he very kindly set me up with a couple of the guys in there and I sort of looked all around and I saw this rectangular watch, which has got the long face. Mm. And I ended up getting that, but it had diamonds down the side, which I know when I'm saying this, I'm going to regret saying it. And it had diamonds down the side and I thought, you know, oh, this is so cool because it's still quite elegant. It had, you know, stainless steel bracelet and it still looked really good, but it had the diamonds on the side. So I felt really, really, really cool, which obviously I wasn't. And
it, well, diamonds are back. So do you still have the watch?
Well, my wife has it now.
Okay.
Which, by the way, is really probably the right wrist it should have been on.
It's okay.
It looked a little on the feminine side. And but yeah, so that's all. So I jumped from one to another. I know, so we all go through phases.
Yeah, of course. Was, I mean, I respect it, though. I feel like you bought what your heart wanted. Yeah. And that's really
and
what
you
this
own
is
it,
all about.
Yeah. And you know when you get something, and I remember, I'd only wear it once in a while. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when you really treasure something.
Like, yeah.
Can't run the risk of scratching it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it'd be a special dinner and you'd be out and you'd just, you know, even you'd be nervous to put your hand on the table.
Yeah.
You know, in the right place, I don't want to scratch the bracelet.
And then your friends were like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You have a problem.
Yeah. And you're like, you know, have you seen the new one? You know, and it's,
you'd
come home. Yeah. And you'd come home and the suit, everything would be thrown, but you'd have time to put the watch back in the box, close it up, give it a little polish and put it back in the drawer.
Yeah.
So, you know, it meant a lot to me, actually, watch. It still does in the sense that my wife's got it. But yeah, that was the sort of jump that I made, which was weird phase, weird jump.
So you went from tag to the Bulgari.
Yes.
And then what was after that?
So after that was, and actually Ben has got a little something to do with this because when I was chatting with Ben and getting a really nice watch, probably about, as I say, about 10 years ago when he first started, he came to London actually and we were just chatting about watches and he showed me some of his ones and I was always into Patek Philippe. It's always been a brand that I just think's, you know, I just love the story behind it. I love the family behind it. You know, the designs, everything about it, I just really like. But it was, you know, sort of out of my price point at the time. And I was looking, and I thought that was a bit of a jump to go sort of in that direction. And so I looked at them for a while and I thought, no, it's just too much. You know, I think I'm going to steer clear of that. So I ended up getting a Santos, Cartier Santos, which is a great one. And my one I got had, it was the Millennium Edition, which not many people knows. And it had the gold dial as well. The numerals. No, it was all yellow, but it had the numerals were in gold as well.
Oh,
cool.
And they called it the Millennium Edition. And I want to say that they made 2000, but don't quote me on that. You know,
2000 and 2000.
In 2000.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got that watch and that was just, you know, that was never come off my wrist.
Yeah.
You know, I slept that thing on. It was just amazing. And then from there, which that's why I got more into Patek actually because of Ben. So that's towards the back part of it. I shouldn't start with that. And again, then Patek Philippe was like, oh, I really want to get one of these watches. And again, I guess because of the profession I'm in, I would see a lot of clients, bespoke clients, who I think are very stylish. And I was looking at the wrist, I get to see a lot of really amazing watches every day.
Yeah.
And I was always like, you know, I don't want to say coolest guys, but you know, some of the guys that came into the suite and were ordering shoes and this really looked like the part. I was like, what's he got on his wrist? You know? And more often than not, at the time, it was either a Patek or a Daytona or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I've got to get involved in this. And I ended up getting a world time
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
Which I still have, which I thought actually appealed to me because it's got all, you know, all those cities throughout. Mm-hmm. And it sounded quite good. I thought, you know, when I go for each city, I can change it, which I actually never ended up doing. I just changed the time. But I don't know why. But yeah, so that was my first sort of, and it had so much going on in the face, which is what I really, really, at the time, loved. And because of my travel schedule, as I say, it just sort of made sense. And then sort of, as I started to get more into watches, I then sort of, I guess, went from an overly busy watch with a lot going on to sort of scaling back and looking for something that was a bit more classic, a bit more plain. And I can't remember which order I got them in. Then I got a couple of other ones. I got the Daytona with a black ceramic dial, the white face. And I'd say that's probably one of my favorite watches. Yeah. I think it's aesthetically beautiful. You know, there's something about Rolex. It's just they're made to be worn. Mm-hmm. You know, they really are. I mean, you could put miles on those things and they seem as strong as anything. And, you know, you literally can, I don't want to use the word beat them up, but you can take them swimming. You can do everything. You know, you can use them in the gym and you look at it the next day and it's in pristine order. And you always think that. So I got that. And then I got a Nautilus 5711, which was the sort of like the Holy Grail.
Yeah. That's what you're wearing
also
today.
Also kind of like the Santos, the Paddock version of this. Santos, think about it.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I like the idea, clean face. I think it looks like a piece of jewellery as well. I've never been a jewellery guy with, like, loads of bits and bobs. I mean, that's why I always thought, actually, getting married, I wasn't going to be able to wear the ring, which, you know, that was non-negotiable. You know, it's like, you better figure out a way to wear a ring. I was like, no. Well, I never worn rings. I don't care.
I'm the same way. I was like, I have to wear something now every day? What?
Yeah, like, it's annoying. And they're like, well, I won't wear mine. Like, okay, fine. Yeah. You know? And then it sort of, you know, and the brand's grown on me quite a lot. And I think I've got an interesting story, you know, with how I got this.
Yeah, we should talk about this. Yeah, so... I'll kind of break the secret, but George did a city guide for us for the upcoming Volume 4 of the Hodinkee magazine. Ooh. So we're going to get an insight into your London. But yeah, you can tell. Let's tell this story. We'll give people a little teaser.
So, okay. So this is probably going now back 3.5 years or so. And obviously the Nautilus is 5711s, you know, it's iconic. It's extremely difficult to get hold of and what have you. But around the corner from my shop is a store called Boodles, which is a great family-run business, similar to mine. All the directors, you know, wear my shoes. They're lovely guys. I've known them a long time. And they have this thing upstairs called The Apartment. And it's, as I say, family-owned, but, you know, they do bespoke pieces. So when I wanted to get my engagement ring, you know, I worked very closely with a gentleman over there and we sort of come up with these designs. Anyway, so we come up with a design that I loved. And then I wanted a shirt to a friend of mine. So I took Jason Statham in there. So he came out of the shop. So I said, when you're in London, you know, I want your opinion on this watch. Come over, this ring, come over and we'll go and have a look at it. So he said, okay. So we come over, had some lunch, and then we strolled in there after, you know, a couple of wines or a couple of bottles of wine, shall I say. never a good idea. And
that's a dangerous thing to do.
Always a great idea.
Dangerous combination. You know, you just got to leave your wallet at home because you could get into serious financial trouble in that place. And so we go up to the apartment and it's really like a living room. It's crazy. So we're sitting there and we're looking at this ring and we're going through it. It's like, yeah, it's great. The cut's good. You know, I wouldn't say I'm an expert in rings. I know I've learned quite a lot because of that, you know, and I wanted to get the right one. But it's like, it's a bit pricey, a bit more than I wanted to spend. And he's like, yeah, go for it. You should buy it. You know, I was like, yeah, it's easy for you to say. Yeah. And he's like, yeah. I was like, yeah, sure.
Those are the friends you want.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just buy it. Don't worry about it. Don't even buy it. Yeah, right. Like, if you're so keen, you buy it. You know, and then we start to get on to talking about watches. So they have a great relationship with Patek and they deal with... They have quite a few shops throughout the UK. Mm. And so we started getting on and actually looking through some old Patek books of different watches and serial numbers and all that sort of stuff. And it got onto about the Nautilus. And it's a watch that I'd been speaking to him about getting for me. Jason wanted one as well. He wanted the 40th year anniversary. It was like chit-chat. And he said, well, let me see what I can do for you guys. So the guy, he speaks to one of the directors. We spent an hour talking about watches. Bearing in mind the ring now's on the other side of the room, sitting above a fireplace, just in this box, not gone how it, and you know, after a few drinks, you forget all about the ring. And we end up getting these two watches, which is this one, and then he got his one. And we walk out of the store and we go back round to my store, you know, super happy with the purchases and what have you. And it was only when I got like close to my shop, I thought, oh shit, fuck, I didn't even buy that ring. You know, that was what we went in there for. And I was like, I felt sick. Anyway, so I couldn't, at the time, I was like,